So, philosopher and futurologist Alexander Bard, we met at European Men's Gathering and Mannsein Conference. He's author of the book Digital Libido, Sex, Power and Violence in the Network Society. And at the Mannsein Conference, you said you're basically a shaman who writes books. By the way, your part on the conference was a highlight for many, many people.
Yeah, I kind of like that idea. So yeah, I'm kind of an introvert actually, but I know how to perform in public. So I do well in both places, I guess.
And at the conference, you spoke about archetypes like the boy, the man, and the god, and how men sometimes don't grow up at all into manhood. And in your book, there's also a term connected to this called mamilla. And I myself see within my circles here in Berlin, for example, actually a lot of boyish behavior and people not growing up and mainly following impulsive pleasures. That's really an issue.
Yeah. So psychoanalytically, this means that at about 1 year of age, there has to be a break with the mother's body. And the mamilla, it's of course a Latin word, and you know, it goes for the tit. But we don't say mama, as you say in Latin, you say mamilla here, because you want to have the virtual idea of the tit, like you're dependent on people. For example, if you're dependent on welfare checks from a welfare state, that's a mamilla. It's kind of having a support system that you're not in control of, but you're actually milking the support system for your resources. That's what we call a mamilla. And the point is that when you break with the mamilla at 1 year of age, you turn the mamilla or your mother's tit from the most loved object in the world into the most hated object, because you have to. You have to get away. Biology helps, because you probably start growing teeth at about the same time. But you need to get away from the tit, so you need to find your own support system in life. Now, the mamilla is still there. That's why it's called childhood. Your parents are likely to support you, if they're good parents, until you can support yourself, you've grown up. But this whole childhood period, when you leave the mamilla, you go towards the phallus. This goes for both girls and boys. And the phallus here, the male body, represents something different from the mother's body. So this difference between the mother's body, which you come from, you come originally from the matrix, you come out of the womb, you go from the womb or the matrix to the mamilla when you're born, which really is there to signal to the mother that the mother and the child are two different entities. But your own separation from the mother's body, so you're a different entity than her, only happens when you're about 1 year old. And at 1 year of age, you have the separation from mamilla. Then your childhood, it's like this, it's the pendulum between mamilla and the phallus. So the father figure or the male figure is something distant. The father or the phallus represents the world out there. It's somebody who's out there in the world conquering and you know, protecting and providing and basically somebody who delivers resources. So you also discover when you leave the mamilla that the milk from the breast that was just magically there for a year actually came from the breast because somebody else supported that system. There had to be a phallus that supported mamilla. The way Freud describes it, Sigmund Freud, is that he basically sees it as an Oedipus or an Electra complex. That means that you envy the mother for getting the attention of something else, or you envy this other thing the mother is attracted to because it isn't you. So the little boy wants to have the father's big penis, and the little girl gets attracted to the idea of having a penis inside of her. This is sexualization. It starts at 1 year of age as well. But you can't, because obviously you're a child, right? So yeah. From that age, when you're 1 year old, all the way up to your teenage years, and your teenage years, your biology starts first. You're a grown-up adult person, biologically speaking, first. After that, maybe 5 years later, you go through a rite of passage in most cultures. And that's what you recognize as a grown-up human being. And this process has to work. What we've done in contemporary society is that this called what's called the phallic intrusion at 1 year of age is not really happening there. The father is too much like the mother. It looks like a second support system that's similar to the mother figure. The father isn't as distant as he should be, so the function of the phallus doesn't really happen. So we have a major problem with the phallic intrusion of varying degrees in Western culture today. We stay infantile for too long. We stay childish for too long. We are not encouraged to grow up and take responsibility for ourselves. So this process is out of sync, and that creates enormous attention in society.
Yeah, the phallic intrusion, I think not everyone knows what that means.
The phallic intrusion means that the phallus is suddenly present in your life when you're 1 year old. It disturbs the fantasy that you had that child and mother were united forever. So the child did not have a sense of a self. The child was just an appendix to the mother's body, and the mother's body would be the world. And suddenly, because that breaks up, because the phallus breaks that fantasy, and suddenly reality is thrown into the picture. And the first sense of reality is this sexualization of the grown-ups. It's very, very, it happens very, very, it's almost like a shock to the system. But it also forces the child, because it's no longer mother, it's non-mother. It's also not father yet, it's non-father. So the child is neither mamilla nor phallus. It's in a state where it cannot support anybody else except take the milk from the mamilla and strive towards becoming phallus. It's the phallic intrusion. Now, of course, that means the teenage rebellion that we talk about in psychology all the time should really be called the rebellion against the phallus, because you have to stand up against the idea that your father or men in general know absolutely everything and they're attractive to women and all that. And you have to stand up to that so you can become your own man. And this is why I talk about boy, man, God, because gods in the general sense are just, they're men who have succeeded at living. The gods are the ones who've lived a full life. They've succeeded everything they set out to do. We call them heroes, for example. You know, you read comic book superheroes. You know, just like boys read about these men that are heroic when they grow up. And that's what they strive for. That's what the phallus is. And since your father can't live up to your ideals, you break with him as well. And that's also important for you to become an autonomous self, become a grown-up human being.
So who is a god these days? What would you say?
That's the problem. Friedrich Nietzsche wrote about this in the 19th century. He literally meant, he wrote about the death of God. He wrote about in a society where he saw the ideals would have disappeared. And they'd only be cynicism and nihilism left because they had nothing to strive for. And I think this is especially damaging to men, more so than women. Because men have to look up to something. They have to get a direction, which is called phallic direction. You've got to get a direction of what you want to achieve and where you want to go. And another mistake we make is that in case we do have a phallic direction in our lives today, it's almost always individual. It's about you and about the goals you set for yourself. Like if you were in some kind of constant competition with all other men. And that is a massive tragedy. I always tell people that if Friedrich Nietzsche was the one who declared that God was dead, then hopefully Alexander Bard and John Söderqvist, my co-writer, would be the philosopher who declared the individual is dead. I think even Michel Foucault claimed in the 1970s that that was his mission in life as well as a philosopher, was to claim the death of man. What we mean with that is that the death of the individual, I want to declare that in my work, because we are tribal human beings. Men collaborate. What's important for you as a young man when you be declared an adult, when you're 18 years old, you've gone through the rite of passage, is that you find a gang of other men your own age. You can then support yourselves. And when you delivered on that promise, when it turns out you survived and you delivered and you could support yourself and your brothers, then you go back out in the world to deliver in abundance. And when men deliver in abundance, when they deliver more than they need, they can support a woman. And they can have a female lover, and they can also be fathers, and they can raise children. But we can't do that until we can deliver that abundance. And that is the entire process as you go through. When you probably are men in tribal societies, men are allowed to have sex until they're about 25 years old. Women have their debut, sexual debut, earlier than men, because women, as soon as they can, and they're declared grown-ups, they go into breeding. And they start breeding children, you know, giving birth to children. And they do that intensely. The most cultures between they're about 18 years old until about 30. And with about 30 years old, they go into what we call the matriarchal state, which is that they start taking care of children that are the younger sisters or even their daughters give birth to. That's how most societies operate. Whereas the men go out there in the world, deliver the protection and the provision, and come back and show an abundance. And that's why abundance is tied to eroticism. That's why if you go on a date with a woman, she will love the fact you pick up the bill and, you know, move the chair and show her you're a gentleman. And that will turn on a woman. That's just a biological instinct that comes out of the fact that man is supposed to protect and provide for the woman.
So in tribal mapping, you're also speaking about the inner circle and the outer circle, with women in the inner and men in the outer circle. And for today's world, it means men would collaborate and go out there, try to provide and, as you say, create abundance, like being helpful, being useful.
We've disconnected this, and it's the state that's done that. We have the same situation here in Scandinavia where I live and in Germany where you live. What we've done over the last 50 years is that we introduced the welfare state. And it turns out that men work a lot more than women do, at least paid work. And they also pay more taxes. And then the money is redistributed. And because women are responsible for reproduction, ultimately, a lot of the resources go to women. So women do not connect. Women get support from the government wherever they go. They don't connect that to the fact that men have worked hard for that to be possible. And then women work as hard as men do, but they often have been isolated in unpaid work. And because we created the capitalist system, where paid work is what we taxed, and men were mostly involved in paid work, and women were mostly involved in unpaid work, it made perfect sense to redistribute the resources to get a fairer system. That's why we started taxing our societies as heavily as we did, and we created a large state because of it, to redistribute resources. But it lost the connections. For women, they lost the connection that men are actually out there in the world creating an abundance that will encourage women to go into the reproductive mode. So at the end of the day, I'm not a conservative. I just think that if we play around with our biologies, we should know what we're doing. And if we do it on a massive scale like we do in contemporary society, we get the current crisis. It doesn't make any sense to us any longer. We've introduced so many different functions to the system now that the regular biological impulse that actually encourages men and women to be equals, but have different roles, has been put out of the system. And it's created a really fucked up system. That's why we have the huge divorce rates right now, especially here in Scandinavia and North America, where most marriages fail. This creates a very unsafe environment for children to grow up in. That means there's material abundance for the children to grow up in, but spiritually, they're very, very lost. So we have a spiritual crisis rather than a material crisis in contemporary society, because we have turned off these sort of social biological functions. We haven't replaced them with something that makes sense to us. So we have a sense-making problem here on a massive scale. That is, I say, the current crisis we're living with.
So what can men, maybe especially young men, do in this, as you said, spiritual crisis these days?
Well, we have to create a spiritual awareness among men. I always say that religion is for men and spirituality is for women. And what I mean with that is religion originally was how we tamed young men so they could serve their community. And without serving your community, without contributing to society, men get totally fucked up. We have a major crisis, psychiatric crisis today among young men. We have bipolar disease on a level we've never seen before. We have male depression on a level we've never seen before. And these psychiatric disorders are basically signaling systems that are warning us that if we don't fix this, it won't work. But let's go back to what we men are supposed to do. A society is never more civilized than the level at which women would love to give birth to children. That means men are ultimately responsible to women. We're ultimately responsible to the matriarch, the oldest woman of the tribe, because otherwise we're not allowed to have sex with women at all. We're denied that possibility if we do not deliver on our promise. That is why my philosophy is radically equal between the genders. It actually prioritizes women over men. Because ultimately, at the end of the day, the matriarchal delivery station is what we're all responsible to. So that should be the horizon for our work. That should definitely be part of our work. That means to get there, we have to understand the current crisis, and we have to understand that it's up to us. We have to get these things together. And over the last 5 years, the men's movement in Europe has grown exponentially. It's now, we know we work in about 15 countries around Europe. you and I are both involved in this work. Yes. And it's become a rite of passage movement. Because to at least get a boy to become a man is absolutely fundamental for this to work. But there are then different stages of manhood. The first one is when you're a young man, you biologically been declared that you're a man. You should at least be able to carry yourself. But the way to carry yourself is that you get a bunch of brothers, a band of brothers together, and starting a company, for example, or joining a workplace where you can deliver and you get paid well because you work hard, means you get a contributive role. And as soon as a man gets a contributive role in society and is allowed to and forced to support himself and his closest brothers, he starts to function well. Then you just set up steps on the where you're going to go next. And this is what I call moving from the taking care of yourself level to the abundance level. To really contribute is not just supporting yourself. So get out of the whole individualism thing. Support the band of brothers. You support each other through different archetypes, through different types of man that are complementary to one another. Then when you get through that 5 to 10 years later, you deliver on the abundance promise. That is when you usually historically become sexually active. You become attractive to women. You become the kind of man that women look up to. And that's when you get really sexually involved. You can have relationships with women and start delivering on your promise to women. But again, men should never operate alone. It's like the Marlboro man is the biggest myth of all. There is no man who operates on his own. That guy does not exist. It's a sort of modern American myth that I can take care of myself and I can run my own things. Well, that's the hermit historically. The hermit is like a monk who isolates himself for years to talk to God or whatever, usually to prepare himself to go back into the community because he can see the world differently from the outside. But the point with human beings is that we're deeply social. We're tribal. We always relate to ourselves from a community. And as men, we relate ourselves from the boys we used to be and the gods we possibly could be, meaning that we're men in the sense that if we manage to live a full life and die with a smile on our face and pass on a heritage to the next generation that we help breed, then we're fully men. And then we can be regarded as divine. We can be regarded as idols to look up to by a forthcoming generation. So it's only after we die we can ever be declared to be lesser gods or be idols of any kind. And if we really succeeded in our lives and we're lucky and had a great support around us and worked hard, we can become these type of men that other men look up to.
So my brother has a son now, 10 months years old. And you once said, when a boy gets older, he should be seduced by the father to go away from the Mamilla state or to go into another state, the next state, instead of staying in this generosity in Mamilla state for too long, should be seduced and into growing, into becoming.
Yeah, the art of seduction is incredibly masculine. Seduction is a word that we need to reconquer as men. We seduce women and we love to seduce women. And hey, it works. When you learn the art of seduction, you become a lot more attractive because women love to be seduced. So women can respond with generosity. Generosity is the female power at its absolute best. The mamilla that feeds us when we, the first year in our lives is generous. Women are generous. We get turned on by women. We get sexually attracted to women when they show generosity towards us. And this has been the problem, for example, with the sort of radical feminism we've seen over the last 20, 30 years, is that it's been cold, demanding. It hasn't been generous and warm. And it's a big turnoff. And that's why a lot of men have an impotence problem because they're confronted with women who meet them with aggression, passive aggression and coldness. And that's not at all what women are about. So even for the child here, it's important to remember this. Again, we go back to psychoanalysis. For the child is non-mother. That means there's a vacuum there. It's like a void. It's very Hegel, by the way, very German philosopher. But the child experiences its own identity as a void. But that's why it's so important already from the very beginning. Logically speaking, it's important for the child that father is not mother. It's not like there's mother and mother. There's mother is non-self, so it's not you. Father is also not you, but father is most importantly not mother. So the father must represent something different than mother. Now, what would be the best thing you as a man could represent to a child as the child grows up? Well, since the child is coming from the mother's body, child has come out of the mother's body. The child is fighting to separate itself from the mother's body and get away from the mamilla. That's exactly, this is a logical operation. The phallus doesn't represent something that's better or bigger or anything than mother's body. It's just different. It's just the alternative. It is a body that doesn't give birth to children. So it must give birth to something else. And what the father's body then gives birth to is what the grown-ups are obsessed with. It gives birth to ideas. I always say also that women give birth to children, men give birth to technology. I think that's a good one-liner to say what men actually, in the way men contribute to civilization is by building stuff, right? Ultimately. And this is why the phallus, the virtual idea of the father, represents this where we're going towards, to then overcome. This is what we do at the end of our teenage years. When we go through the rite of passage, that is the separation from the phallus, so we can become our own phallus. And that's why it's important when we leave, we will also break with the father figure. That's why it's important that you have a bunch of brothers that welcome you. You have guys of your own age who are on the same adventure as you are and want to go from being declared fully grown up men who can now support themselves. They don't need neither phallus. They don't need mamilla. They can be their own phallus. But to go from that state to a man who actually delivers on the abundance and can seduce a woman sexually and the children mentally, so that the children want to be more like the father, want to be grown-ups.
Okay, it's on a good way then, I guess. And if man giving birth to ideas and technology is taking over everything right now, then it's really time for us as men to get our shit together, right?
It is. So the way things used to work is that in the sense that men protected and provided, they also dominated the social arena. And the system we're leaving now, when we go into the digital age, and it's been very obvious this year with the coronavirus, because everybody's gone digital this year. And we're going to stay digital in many ways. We actually, digital is going to control our lives and even our physical presence and our physical life when we meet people face to face, whatever, is going to be controlled by the digital world. The digital world is going to dominate the world from now on. What has happened, though, is that in the previous society we lived in, which we called industrialist capitalist society, we're now moving into an informationalist attentionalist society instead. But the age we're leaving behind had three major institutions. Any society, after a while, when it stabilizes, will have three major institutions of power. There will be what's called the real power, which sits on the resources in that society. There will be an imaginary power. That's usually what you think of first when you hear the word power. And there should be a symbolic power, which is the power over the narrative, the storytelling power. So if you go back, say, to before the printing press, before 1450, we lived in a feudal society based on agriculture. And in that type of society, the real power would be the aristocracy, the landowners. The imaginary power would be monarchs, the monarchy, kings and queens and courts. And the symbolic power would have been the church, because the symbolic power was that you went to church on Sundays at 11, and then you were told the story about the world. That whole system fell apart after the French Revolution in 1789, and it took quite a while, but with the Napoleonic structure in Europe in the 19th century, we started to invent a new triad, a new system, where the real power was capital. It was the bourgeoisie, it was the people who owned stock in factories and industries. The bourgeoisie was this power. The second imaginary power became politics. And politics, of course, eventually, at least in Europe, became democratic, and parliaments and prime ministers and presidents or whatever, and they replaced the monarchy as a center of imaginary power. And then the symbolic power became academia, and academia tied to mass media. That means that academia was the place where you produced the narrative about the world. It pretended more and more to be scientific. You know, this was a new kind of story, told us about human beings and our conditions, existential conditions in the world. And then it used mass media to sort of pump out the message. So the pop message would go through mass media. If you didn't want to write read academic papers, you would read the newspaper in the morning or listen to the radio or watch television. Now, that whole system is the one that's falling apart today. And what has happened then is that men have retracted, because men go into technological mode, become more innovative. 93% of the world's tech startups today are run by men. This technology sector is dominated by men. If we look at what's happening in the stock exchanges of the world over the last year, we've seen the tech companies have gone through the roof. And all the major, 10 major corporations in the world today are new tech companies run by young men. So men have come back in a big way. But this is the new, what we call the digital patriarchy. So the patriarchy is back in this way. And the question is then, what is happening with the matriarchy? What is happening with women? Well, it turns out that a lot of women have invested in the old institutions rather than the new ones. And that means we've left the area of politics to a lot of women who walked into politics. Maybe they should have been listened to all along. We should have matriarchs, older women involved in politics, because they're wise and they've lived a long life and they can make good decisions. You got Angela Merkel in Germany. We have Margaret Thatcher in the UK. It often turns out that women step in, older women step in and take over and take charge of things when men fail. It comes to politics. So politics become this area where women have invested heavily. Women have invested heavily in academia. And that means we now have gender studies and we have radical feminism moved into academia. The social sciences have stopped being scientific. They become propaganda machines for very often bitter radical feminists who are now attacking men openly. It's very dysfunctional, right? And that's because academia is dying and nobody's reading academic papers any longer. The social sciences are no longer scientific. They're just propaganda institutions. The only things that actually still work within science are basically education for engineers and possibly doctors. That means that only those areas that are actually tied to technology are the only ones that still work in academia. As for the rest of academia, it's become redundant. We're going to see a massive crisis in academia over the next 10 to 15 years when people discover that if they want to learn something in life and then take a test and get a certificate, they've learned something, they can do all of that online. This would be a massive crisis for the world's universities and academic institutions. Just like mass media is dying too, because mass media is dying because we've all moved online. And we get our news online these days and we debate and discuss online. And because of algorithms, we can now find exactly what we're looking for online. So we no longer need advertising. We no longer need marketing efforts. And we actually hate it. All these things are now dying. And those industries, like the advertising industry, the marketing industry, are dying. And they're dying by exploding first and becoming fundamentalists. You know, like fundamentalist Christianity, fundamentalist Islam. Advertisers think they're more important than ever. Actually, we don't need them at all any longer. Algorithms have replaced them. So digital is now moving in. But women have invested heavily in these old institutions. They moved into politics, they moved into old industry, and they moved into academics. And now they're discovering that with the arrival of digital, suddenly a patriarchy is back because all the big tech companies are run by men. And the new structures that will develop over time, politics will be replaced by something we call sensocracy. Since we have sensors everywhere that sense absolutely everything around us, and we have an Internet of Things and an Internet of Phenomena in general, that means the whole planet will be covered by the Internet. So you literally vote every second of your life if you tie your behavior to AI. But if you vote every second of your life through your behavior, why the hell would you go and vote every 4 years? Politics will fall apart. And then academia will fall apart because the way we certify that we know something and we speak with some kind of authority is now done through algorithms. And once the algorithms start showing the direction to who you should go to get some advice in your life, then why the hell would you need universities for? So it is the same paradigm shift as when we moved from the feudal agricultural society into the industrialist capitalist society. We're now moving from industrialism and capitalism, moving into a society of informationalism, which is all about data and the processing of data, and attentionalism, meaning that through my behavior, I give attention to things, and that ultimately determines what I consider to be quality in my own life. And since everybody does that, we're creating a whole new power structure that is not even built on money any longer. It's built on the principle of attention. Now, this means that men are going to come back in a big way, but it also means that as long as the old institutions have a lot of power and influence and are very dysfunctional, we should expect these institutions to be run by very confused women, because the men have retracted. So it's we haven't really figured out yet on where young men should look for guidance and advice. And all we can say to the young men is that since you're also co-creating this new society together with new technologies, you've got to figure out for yourself how you're going to do this well. And obviously, when you look at guys like Mark Zuckerberg, they haven't done very well. Facebook is failing massively right now. So they didn't build the tech companies with the proper spirit. That was the problem. So we need to replace all of the current tech companies with better ones. And they need to be built by young men.
So why is it that women taking over those state institutions, as you said, academia and politics? Is it like a transition function women inhabit? Or what is it?
We men have failed on the women. We failed to deliver the abundance properly. We've also created a huge welfare state that also creates confusing signals for women, that they no longer need us. They get the state so they can live on their own and argue about who pays for the bills for the children and things like that. It is a very dysfunctional system. All of this should signal to us that this is no longer working. And the problem for women is that they work hard, certainly work hard in life. The problem is for women that they work hard in society. They work hard, but they are not risk-taking. And because women are not risk-taking, that means that they take the safe route towards what they think is success. That means women are far less likely than men to look at a new area that requires entrepreneurship to be conquered. They don't see the world as if there's a new territory to be explored. It's always men who lead an exodus into the new era. It's always men who lead that. And women then follow, as they should. But when women are supposed to lead and lead where we're going, if women are expected to know the vision and have a strategy of where we're going to go as a society into the future, the problem is that women avoid risks at all times. They hate taking risks. A woman always wants to have her back cover, right? If you go on a date with a woman and you got a seat by the wall and you got a seat opposite that, the woman will always expect that she gets to have the seat by the wall. Why? She doesn't want to have other women sitting behind her back who can backstab her. That's how women operate, basically. It's a protection mechanism. And it works for them as long as risk-taking is not actually where the reward is located. And that's why it becomes difficult for women to be entrepreneurs in the sense of being creative about it. They prefer to go into safe positions that already exist. So, for example, in Europe right now, women focus on studying law. They focus on studying economy. They focus on studying in medicine. They're moving into these professions, and they work hard, but they don't move into entrepreneurship. They don't take risks. They hate taking risks. Whereas men take possibly more risks than is even good for them. That's why men die much more than women do. And they die often more than women do at a young age. Men go into battlefields and fight it out. But men also take the spirit with them when they look at, for example, technology and innovation. And that's why it's easier for a man to gamble and take risks and then get the support from other men to limit the risk. That's, for example, by the limited company that was invented in Venice in the 14th century. It was absolutely brilliant. We built all this wealth of the West that we talk about today, of Europe and North America, is built in the day there was a limited company to begin with, which you could build capitalism on, so that a young man didn't risk his own life. And young men would risk investments. He would risk investments of older men who believed in him and would give him capital to invest in his ideas. But if he failed, he shouldn't die. If he failed, he should be given another chance. But this whole risk-taking and risk-avoiding mechanisms is incredibly underrated. It's something, for example, that feminism refuses to discuss. Because at the end of the day, when we go through a paradigm shift like we currently do, when it pays off to be adventurous, pays off to be entrepreneurial, that is the return of a patriarchy of men who run the world through technology. But it's not enough to just be successful in business, like a lot of men think today. We must also start to take responsibility for the imaginary power, what replaces politics. We have to start to take responsibility for symbolic power, what will replace the universities, what will replace mass media. And in what way can we as men handle these new functions responsibly? And that's the kind of work that I do as a philosopher.
So everything is going online, everything is going digital. So is it correct to see attention war, so to speak, coming?
I think it's already happening. What digital has done is that it has put a megaphone into the mouth of about 8 billion people at the same time. We've never seen so much junk before in our lives. So people, it's like people are spewing out tons of shit all the time because people are communicating immensely, right? But they're also making their own commentaries on everything they do. But we have to remember that this was also the beauty of democracy. So the beauty of democracy was that through mass media, a lot more people could comment on the system. So the system had to become more plural. So we replaced the king as the dictator in our societies and democratize society, and we could vote for different politicians and vote for different parties. So power was more widely distributed in a society, and that created an abundance in itself because it created the potential for people to specialize in academics or specialize in industry or specialize in politics or specialize in mass media and do all these different things that had power. That was the power structure of the old industrial age. Now this is being dispersed even further, and the problem, though, is that we cannot have 8 billion people running the world through megaphones. We have to have some kind of power structure to this. And what then happens naturally is that it starts out as a flat society. Everybody has the same assets. Everybody can go online. Everybody has a Gmail account, a Facebook account, a Twitter account, whatever. None of these things cost anything. It operates towards zero cost. So it's made widely available. You can go to Kenya or Brazil or America or Uganda, where you like, doesn't matter. You will find people are online all the time. That means the creativity is now being dispersed as well. You no longer need Silicon Valley to start a new tech company. You can start it anywhere in the world, right? So this is dispersed power. But out of that system, you get an anarchy. And we cannot operate through an anarchy. That's why it's so confusing right now. That's why there's so many conflicts, especially in America, that loves to tell the world the story about itself. We get Biden versus Trump and all that. Biden versus Trump, after all, is still old power structures, but we also get the new struggles with Silicon Valley and big tech against the rest of the population in America. That's certainly digital. That's certainly part of the new age. So we see these patterns and these conflicts now. But the fundamental conflict that we need to be aware of is the conflict between the new and the old. And since we do not have a sensocracy that's installed yet and that works, and actually the different theories on how it should operate, then we cannot imagine an opposition to politics. So people go back to politics all the time and they think everything is going to happen within politics. When politics is actually now totally dysfunctional and can no longer operate against technology. Technology beats politics easily. I mean, Washington, D.C., who's the most powerful person there? Is it Joe Biden? No, it isn't. It's Jeff Bezos. Right. So it is, technology is already taking over. All the five biggest lobby organizations in Washington, D.C. are now run by tech companies. That means big tech is essentially controlling America. And it's also increasingly controlling the world. And in China, they're already creating a sensocracy, but they plan the sensocracy to be dictatorship of the Communist Party. That means the Communist Party wants to control tech. That means that all the big tech companies in China are feeding the Communist Party central computer with all the data they ever produce through their operations. So they're trying to invent a sort of solid system in China with a political dictator at the top, who then has a bunch of sons around the different tech companies. That's a kind of structure, Confucian digital age structure that China's trying to create. And we need philosophically to respond to that. For example, Jan Söderqvist and I are working with people in Korea, Taiwan, Japan, and India on creating a different model than the Chinese one, a model with more plurality and therefore more creativity and entrepreneurship to it. But it's also going to be fiendishly difficult to create such a model without concentrating power into one hand, which is what the Chinese are trying to do. This is an old discussion. Like, do you run a society through dictatorship and the dictate of a guy who's supposed to know more than anybody else? Or do you run a more plural society, more inviting, but also with larger risks involved? Because that's what you get. That's why a million people will die from COVID-19 in America and only a few thousand will die in China, although the disease originated in China. This is the problem with plural open societies. They also take larger risks as a whole. And when they move into a crisis, the crisis often gets worse. And we have to be honest about that. We've got to respond philosophically to the Chinese fantasy of the sasocracy. Then the third and last leg is what replaces academia. And academia and mass media will be replaced by something we call protopianism. And the protopians are essentially the creators. These are people who artistically create and surf on the new technologies and use new technologies to express themselves. And they will certainly be tribal. They will not be individualists. So we look at the current sort of tribal subcultures that we find online. And we see a lot of creativity coming out of these subcultures. And this is the future of protopianism. This is the future of education. This is the future of enculturation. So you become a cultured person. You become a fully grown up person mentally, culturally, through the protopian products that will develop eventually. But we're not so worried about those. They will come quite naturally because there's tons of artistic people out there who know how to use new technologies. And if you look at companies like Netflix and HBO and the new way they do storytelling, you don't go to the movies any longer because you get these series that you binge watch on weekends and things like that. Well, that's already a new way of telling stories that is much more digital than the previous way of telling stories was through mass media, including going to the cinemas. So storytelling is moving that direction already. So I'm not worried about the protopian aspect of this. I'm worried about the sensocracy versus politics aspect of it, because it's ultimately where power and control will remain, but it will move from a political to a sensocratic system. That's going to be very difficult. And we men need to step up because we're going to be at the center of that whole move.
Yeah. So what should we do now? Like the people who listen to this podcast, of course, a lot of men. So what should we do now?
The ultimate goal we're responsible towards is together make sure that we live in a society where women love to give birth to children. If we ignore that, we haven't learned the lesson from classical feminism we should learn. Okay? We can't avoid that any longer. Women now have the pill. Women are now much in control. And an issue that I never, ever discuss with men is the issue of abortion, for example. I think abortion is best left to an issue between older and younger women. Okay. Leave it to the women. Don't have an opinion about it. You don't understand what it means to be pregnant. You don't understand what it means to give birth to a child. That's a mystery to you as a man. Just respect women for that. Leave that to women to decide, right? That is the ultimate horizon we must be responsible towards. In tribal society, you are not allowed to ever have sex with a woman unless the matriarch first gave her consent. The brothel madams control the world, essentially. So if we know that as the ultimate horizon, we know that our relationship towards women is absolutely fundamental. Now, as men, the number one thing is to find strong social bonds with other men. And there are two things you need. You need relationship with men your own age. You want to be popular among the men of your own age. So make sure you have a strong social network of men that are your own age. Now, if your wife takes you to dinner with another couple because she wants to see your best friend, and that's the guy you hang out with, you're no longer in control of that process. Social bonds are not created with other men that are thrown at you because they happen to be your neighbors. You got to go out there in the world and find the other man that you hang out with, that you can be a man with. Never, ever let your woman or your wife take that position. Never, ever let your wife be your therapist. You become a mommy's boy in no second at all. At the end of the day, she will be disgusted with you and probably leave you. Women do not want to marry boys. They want to marry men. Okay? So to be a man, you need a strong social network of other men around you. You also need men that are older than you, that are wiser than you, they've been around longer than you have. And your father is not enough. You need more men around you. You need fathers. You need older men around you. And you should especially look for men that are of the same archetype that you are. So the kind of man that you are, think of what kind of man you are and imagine you are successful with your life. And then look for and hope to find a man who has been successful within your archetype, probably some 25, 30 years older than you are. So he's ahead of you. So you can look at him as your mentor. And this is what we do in the men's movement. So please join the men's movement in Europe when you do it. Because in the men's movement, we are always talking about this as a social movement and it's based on men's groups. And if you were involved with the men's group, it's not necessarily your best friends. You should have your best friends anyway and socialize with them, and they're probably your own age. But a men's group has a variety of ages and complementary roles. So it's not necessarily the guys you hang out with all the time. These are the guys you see on a regular basis, because they will call you out on your bullshit and expose it, and they will loving you, support you, and take care of you so you can walk in the right direction in your life. And that's why I think the men's movement is very, very important.
Yeah, I also have a mastermind group, and the oldest is 56, I think, and the youngest 21.
Yes, yeah. That's really good. That's really good. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, I think so too. And it has consequences if we don't have these kinds of circles. Like at the moment, I see a lot of people having this Corona wars and go deeply into theories and conspiracies and stuff like this.
So I always tell men that astrology among women and conspiracy theories among men are equally common. That means the only difference between a conspiracy theory and astrology is hormones. Most conspiracy theories are basically astrology. So it's just like, yeah, they fall for this, and a lot of men get very engaged in these things. That's a lack of male leadership. You start fantasizing about a world that is controlled by somebody, but it's not controlled by you. Well, then you failed. If you get involved in conspiracies all the time, and you're not a part of these conspiracies yourself, you have no power over the world. That's just a lazy way of neglecting your own responsibility towards yourself by saying that, well, the world is controlled by these conspiracies anyway, I can't do anything. Well, that's just boyish and lazy, right? So no, the world is not run by conspiracies. The problem is this one, there are no conspiracies, and that's what's actually really shocking to conspiracy theorists, because they hate that the world is not controlled by somebody. But it isn't controlled by anybody right now. It's all up in the air. And we need a new, proud digital patriarchy that delivers to women properly and make women happy enough to want to give birth to children. And without that, we will lose, and we will lose ourselves in that process. So it's a spiritual awakening. And I think what men need to learn again is to differentiate between the profane and the sacred. And the easiest way to do that is when we talk about your archetype, your personality type. Yes, it's very, very likely, if you're lucky, that you can work with the very thing you're talented at. And if you could do that, your profession can also become your archetype. But your archetype can also be something you don't do for money. For example, being a father. You don't get paid to be a father. You actually pay for it. That means it's sacred. And the realms of sacred and profane, I think, is something that's very important for men to make distinctions. Become aware of the things you do in life because you get paid for them. Whether you like them or not, this is what you get paid for. This is where the resources come from. This is where you create the abundance you're going to deliver to women eventually. It comes from here, right? But sacred, those are the things we usually do on a Sunday. Those are the things we do when we have time off. And that's why, yeah, there's nothing wrong in watching a really good Netflix series, but not if you do it every night. Yeah, you have your evenings to yourself, you can watch a good Netflix series. Well, invite a friend over and it's much more fun. And watch it with somebody else. And don't go into these computer games things when you're sitting isolated, just shooting, booming your things all the time and killing time. If you start killing time, you're certainly doing the wrong thing with your spare time, because that's sacred time. Sacred time should be meaningful. And being social, hanging out with friends, dating girls or women, you know, all the things you could do in your spare time when you're a social human being are much better for you than just sitting alone to yourself. Loneliness is your own worst enemy. It's not only terrible when it's forced on you, it also makes you a smaller human being.
And it also means that online we don't create this world around ourselves, right? Like a boyish behavior being the center of the universe online, but also collaborate and work in groups, even online, right?
Yeah. And we should learn from the last 10 years. The 2010s was the last decade in this sense, but probably had to learn from these mistakes we made. So a lot of men ended up just doing shootout computer games on their own. They're not social at all. Just lonely. It's just endlessly repetitive. It's just killing time. Yes. Stop killing time. Do something meaningful with your life. Do something meaningful with your spare time. Just don't kill time. Get out there in the world. Don't sit alone. The other thing was what women did, and women made a terrible mistake. Yes, they did socialize, which was better, but they socialized in a completely empty, repetitive way. For example, with Instagram, eventually you had millions and millions of women posting pictures of themselves smiling all day long and posting pictures of babies and cats. Okay. It became so terrible, so mediocre that they're finally giving up and Instagram has already peaked and it's about to die. But women spent the last 10 years doing something completely meaningless. We're just posting endlessly, posting the same types of pictures, pretending to be happy and successful in their lives, which is just a lie. And that's how women are suffering now from eating disorders and they're suffering from total breakdowns. They have all kinds of mental problems because of that, because they also didn't understand digital and use digital in all the wrong ways. And men are suffering from very often from a loneliness that leads into psychiatric breakdowns that young men suffer from today in society as well. So we're getting these disorders. There are signals to us that we are not using the new technologies in a humane way. So we got to go back to fundamentally understand what does it mean to be human? And what does it mean to be human to interact in these new ways that we interact through today? How can we do that as well as possible? That's what we need to rediscover. And we've learned a lot. We've been in the digital realm for the last 30 years and we've learned what it isn't and what it should be. And we're now slowly discovering what it must be instead. And we're trying to create that kind of digital environment.
So yeah, work in groups and create real meaning instead of killing time is the thing to go, as you said. And killing time would somehow be killing oneself in some sense anyway. And I have two more things to cover. In your work, you describe the inner and the outer circle, men and women. You describe the 4% outside of the circles, like the shamans, the crazy ones, the diplomats. And you also describe the gays and lesbian who are like go-betweens between men and women, communicator bridges, and who understand both more. So that some religion are against gay and lesbian people means actually that they are against nature or life, right?
Oh, yeah. It's terrible. I mean, if we are around and we function the way we do, we probably have a role to play. You have no idea how many gay bartenders I've convinced in my life to become couple therapists to make even more money. And they start laughing. When you've got a problem with your woman and your marriage is falling apart, get a gay guy. Because they will sit and laugh at you and your woman because they will understand both you and her. And it's impossible for you to understand your woman. It's usually impossible for her to understand you. That is often where sexual attraction starts. It starts with an impossibility. It starts with something that can never be overcome. That's what sexual attraction often is. So what I strongly defend is what I call the shamanoid and androgynous personalities. And the shamanoid personalities are at the very outskirts of the entire tribe. So they're go-betweens between tribes. That's why the shamans also take care of religion for us. They talk to the gods so we don't have to talk to the gods ourselves. Religion often operates through that way in that the shamanoid people take care of vertical communication with the outside world, which is religion. And they take care of horizontal communication with the outside world, which is diplomacy with other populations. So that's connections between tribes. The shamans, the shamanoid people, they are very similar to the androgynous. The only thing is the shamanoid people tend to be heterosexual. They don't have to. Most shamanoid people I met in my work are usually don't even understand the question. Well, why would I wake up in the morning and disqualify myself from fucking 4 billion people? What a strange idea. So the shamanoid people are very free in the sense that they're just sexual, period, right? They don't have bi or homo or heterosexuality. They're just sexual. But the androgynous people are also interesting. They are about 4% of the population that clearly show these sort of androgynous traits. And that's why I love them. I call them the gays and the dykes and the trannies, right? These are go-betweens. That's why women should be comfortable in the male-dominated outer circle. And that's often what I said. A lesbian with a bazooka gun is probably a really good woman to take with you on the hunt, if you're allowed. Right. So, and the same thing goes with the gay guys. The gay guys are tremendously useful in the fact that they take care of the relationship between men and women when those relations must not be sexualized. That's what gay guys are great at. They're also great at many other things. For example, we discovered when we did our men's events that we didn't want everybody to run around with cameras and take pictures or have microphones and turn everything into media like you often do, because a lot of the work is very sensitive. But we discovered early on that the guys you could really trust with having a camera with them to take pictures with love and care and be sensitive about it. What are the gay guys? The gay guys are wonderful with taking cameras with into our events and then, you know, cover, you know, shoot those pictures that both have the sensitivity and the beauty of men, because they obviously appreciate men, even sexually. That's the point of being gay. But also have a loving eye towards seeing the dynamism between different men when they hang out together in a loving way. So when we started to look at the bigger map, we'll discover that a lot of things that shamanoid and androgynous people are really good at, and they should be allowed to prosper in those archetypes and should be honored for it. And one of the strongest moments we had in men's work is when the couple of gay guys walk into the room and, you know, on a Friday night and declare to the other guys, well, you were terrible with us. You bullied us when we were 11 years old at school because you didn't know better. You hadn't understood and figured out that you would need us to date those women you were so fucking attracted to 5 years later. You hadn't figured that out yet. And I think we need to honor the gay men and we need to honor the lesbian women for the role they played, for unthankfully they've had to play that role for thousands of years often in our culture. And we need to embrace those religions that appreciate the shaman or the androgynous characters, rather than religions that are opposed to sexuality per se, and therefore they attack sexual minorities. That is a great major spiritual turnaround that needs to be made. And to be honest about it, if we did men's work really properly, we would have probably more lesbian women around who would come to the men's events. But I see that it may be something that materialized some 5 to 10 years from now, because right now in the men's movement, we need the gay guys around first before the gay guys can go off to the women's events if they like to, because the gay guys need to be honored for the archetypes they are and for the fantastic men that they are and for the full men that they are. And only by embracing this sort of tribal mapping model, the understanding that we're all evolutionary winners if we're around here, and we need to find our respective positions in the inner circuit, the outer circuit, and in the androgynous caste in between those two, and the shamanoid caste between our tribe and the outside world.
Yeah, very nice. And I would like to end with a question from my mastermind member, Werner, our eldest. He asked, what is the worst experience you learned the most from? That is his question.
Oh, it's definitely been from shamanic work. But the problem with shamanic work is you don't speak about it in public. This is why in my philosophy, I talk about the Bard Absolute. And that's not my name, Bard. This is B-A-R-R-E-D in English. Bard Absolute, like it's closed. You cannot get inside of it. Bard Absolutes, for example, the grown-up world is to a large extent a Bard Absolute to children. You want to keep your children away from violence and pornography. Yeah, okay. Until they're ready to understand it, so they could even enjoy it. There are Bard Absolutes for grown-ups too. So when you go into deep spiritual work and shamanic work, you basically close the room. And what happens there stays there. And you can only go into those kind of spaces when you're prepared for them. You're spiritually and psychologically prepared to handle them. And I would say that kind of work can be incredibly demanding. And for example, I work with psychiatry. I'm a psychoanalyst. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I work with psychiatrists all the time to sort of complement them in their roles. Again, about working with archetypes. So I work with psychiatrists and they're fantastic people to work with. And that can be hauntingly difficult. I mean, it's just a... A person who suffers from a major psychiatric disorder is in such hell and under such torture, it's unimaginable. But if you want to understand where they're at, you've got to put yourself in a position where you suffer from the same things. At least temporarily, you have experiences that are similar to theirs. Otherwise, you cannot have empathy with them. They will not believe you. You have to look somebody in the eyes and say, I am not constantly in the hell you're in, but I've been there and I know what you're going through. And that's why the most horrible things I've experienced in my life have actually been induced. That's what you do in shamanic work. Shamanic work is not about taking trips and flying out there, eating mushrooms and having fun and laughing all the time. No, that can happen in shamanic work too. It can be very ecstatic, that's for sure. But shamanic work can also be deeply, deeply troubling and deeply, deeply horrible to be in, because you have to go through the entire spectrum to understand how the world works. So I would say these sort of organizing dude states that I've been in have been my most horrible experiences in my life. Then mentally, yes. I mean, say you work with people's psyches, and sometimes you can't just reach to people. Sometimes people, even you love, you cannot reach them. They live in such a dark place that they often consider suicide or something like that is the only option. And you can't even reach them. And no matter how powerful and convincing and empathetic and professional you are, you just can't reach them. And this kind of sense that you can't reach out to people that you really care about, I would say is also one of those most horrible states you can be in as a human being. But that's just the fact of life. I hope that's the answer he was looking for.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. And I think we covered a lot of ground and content and a lot of stuff to listen to. And it was a very nice ride. And yeah, I think you're very honest and clear about your points, which is also a reason why you get some pushback, like, for example, John Peterson experiences, right?
You start threatening people's careers because the careers are built on the wrong ground anyway. They shouldn't have careers. Then you have enemies. That's just what happens. It's just a natural thing, but that's also to be expected. I would just love to give one recommendation to men. When you're looking for leaders, when you're looking for older men to guide and lead you, always look for the authentic phallus and not for a fake phallus. So never believe a leader who tries to unify you with other people through hating something. That's terrible leaders. You had one in Germany called Adolf Hitler, and he united people by hating Jews. This is the fake phallus. And we write about it in the Digital Liberator book that the phallus that we should never be proud of, the phallus that we should be disgusted with as men, are the men who try to unify us through hating something. That's why I never buy into any of these stories of men who hate women or problems with women. I said, no. Women work the way they do. And it's your damn job as a man to figure out how that works and then seduce them.
Yes.
It is. And the same thing. So that was goes for authentic leadership always points you and your brothers towards the heroic. You can be a greater man than you are. You have all these potential, and you will only become that greater man that you want to be by collaborating with other men. Through the support of other men, you can become the greatest man. And that's what authentic leadership is about. It always points towards the heroic, and it never uses hatred to get ahead in life.
Yeah, absolutely agreement here. And I also don't like men going MGTOW or anti-woman at all. And last question is, who is an authentic leader for you? Is it Jordan Peterson, or who is an authentic leader for you?
Yeah, Jordan Peterson is a good guide. He's a good door opener. He works very similar to me in Sedeculist, and he's kind of the pop version of what we do. So yeah, it's a good place to start is to read Jordan Peterson and then dig into Bartol Sedeculist and go into the deeper philosophy. But we're certainly aligned. I know Jordan personally, he's a great guy. He's got a fantastic family, and he's a good starting point for men's work today. Definitely so.
All right. Yeah, I definitely have your book here, Digital Libido, and still having the fun to read through it. I have the English version. I know there's also a German version, which is definitely easier for some people. So thank you very much again. Definitely one of my favorite interviews and very, very insightful.
Thank you so much for having me, Martin. And I'm looking forward to returning to men's work in Germany and seeing all these fantastic German men as soon as the corona fog is over.
Always welcome. Thank you. And bye, everybody.